Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to a special edition of the Supertone Show.
Thank you.
The Moody Blues and Question, which was first released as a single on the 24th of April in 1970 on the Threshold record label. And it's their second highest charting song ever. And it reached number two in the UK and stayed in the charts for a whopping 3 months. And it's also the lead track on their sixth album, A Question of Balance, released a few months later, which went to number one, woo, in the UK, and number three in the US of A.
I think a question of bank balance may be in order there as well.
Probably much needed by then, actually. Yeah. But it was, they'd done, well, a few out by then.
The this show is special, and it is featuring another of my indulgences in terms of guitar players, and the most underrated, I think, of all the guitar players that I sort of really like, and that's Justin Hayward from the Moody Blues. And you know, I grew up with the Moody Blues. I, you know, with Atomic Rooster and all the other bands that I loved, and that was my first album, Tommy Rooster, of course, but this was very close to being one of my first albums that I bought, well, the best of, which we still listen to even now. It's a double album, and the best of the Moody Blues. We've got all the individual ones right up to the ones where it's starting to get a bit dodgy, aren't they?
Yeah.
But Justin Hayward is probably the, well, he's definitely the most underrated guitar player that I really know of, you know, and I wanted to explore it a little bit today about his playing. And you know, and if you look at him on Wikipedia, his list of songs that he's written, it's about 5 pages.
You could put it on wallpaper and paper a house.
You could. It's incredible, you know. But look, what about Justin Hayward? Who is he? Ooh. Where does he come from?
Do you know he was on This Is Your Life as well, Michael Aspel?
Oh, well, there we
which
are.
Which is, if you're listening in the United States or internationally, because we do broadcast around the world.
We
on
do.
It's This Is Your Life is a programme where you get a surprise presenter will turn up and surprise you and has a red book, and it goes, takes you through your life really, and you get these guests, and you're in a TV studio, and the guests come in and go, oh my gosh, I've not seen you for like 50 years, remember when you played?
Yeah.
And you were just running down the road naked, you know, when you were 5, you know, and hanging off trees and things like that. So anyway, here we go, This Is Your Life.
Justin Hayward.
David, he's still alive, which I love, by the way, as well. David Justin Hayward. So his first name's David.
I didn't know that. There we are.
No, I mean, it's actually been quite interesting. He was born on the 14th of October in 1946 at Dean Street in Swindon in the United Kingdom.
Blimey.
His father was an English and Latin divinity teacher, and his mother a domestic science teacher.
Holy smoke.
Indeed. Now, his music, this is, I love this, right? His interest in music started really young, when he was about 5, because his grandfather left him his whole collection of vinyl, 78 RPMs. And it just opened up a whole world of imagination for him, so he said. So he taught himself to play the ukulele, soon progressed to the guitar. By age 10, he'd formed a skiffle band called the Riversiders. I love that. By the early teens, he was playing in loads of different local groups. And at age 15, he bought his first guitar, which was the Gibson 335.
Is that right?
It was.
His first guitar?
Yeah.
Well,
as in his first... He bought his first Gibson, sorry.
Oh, right, okay.
That's right, actually, because there's a point where he goes, I had all these other guitars beforehand, just thinking about it, and he had to keep modifying them because they weren't up for the job.
Right, okay.
Right, so when I say, for me, though, I've read this and I've kind of romanticised it, so I've just suddenly had this, like, in my imagination, his first guitar was this amazing Gibson, because he sort of waxes lyrical about how amazing it was when he was 15 years old. Anyway, he finally got that one. So he left school, age 17, and I love this as well. He answered an advert in the Melody Maker, which is one of the major music newspapers in the UK, and successfully auditioned for UK rock and roll hero Marty Wilde.
Right. Composed that.
Yeah. Is it Marty Wilde?
Yeah, I think so, isn't it?
No. Oh, it might be.
I think it is, yeah.
Oh, it could be, you know. Carry on. Yeah, I'm just thinking what is... I can see his face, but I think I'm thinking of somebody else anyway. So, And Justin credits Marty with encouraging him to become a songwriter. So he made several recordings with Marty Wilde's 3 band and appeared at the London Palladium. And it's just a little bit left now. So by the end of 1965, he'd got 4 songs that he felt ready to record on his own, which led him to sign an 8-year publishing contract with skiffle artist and record producer Lonnie Donegan.
Wow.
So, but he was a little bit, he regretted it really, because it meant that really all the songs he wrote before 1974 were owned by Lonnie Donegan's label, Tyler Music.
No.
So, yeah. So he signed an eight-year recording deal. So he's a bit like, oh, shit. So anyway, so his solo recording debut, London Is Behind Me, was released by Pye Records on the last day of 1965, but it failed to make an impact on the charts. And he had another follow-up with I Can't Face the World Without You. That was released by Parlophone in 1966 with similar results. So what's quite beautiful about him, though, is that he's a songwriter, and he started off from an early age. And I just think, what a guy. And there he is. And we can talk. What I want to do is share the story of the Moody Blues and his involvement with the Moody Blues as we play the music.
Massive sound. Moody Blues, Ride My Seesaw. What a fantastic, fantastic song. hit single released on 12th of October 1968 on the Durham record label, which was part of Decca, of course.
Yes.
And produced as ever by the marvellous Tony Clark, who was the fifth member of the Moody Blues. Or was it six? I can't remember. How many were there? There were five of them, weren't there?
And then there was another chap who plays the flute in the tambourine.
Yeah, the sixth member, yeah, because it was Graham Edge, Justin Haywood, John Lodge, Mike Pinder, and then, of course, Tony Clark, who was the...
Yes.
I can't count now. But anyway, it's marvellous. And what I love about that track from a guitar playing perspective is, firstly, the opening bit and the fills all the way through are all obviously on the 335. And he plays principally to an AC30, and you can hear that sound. It's almost Beatlish. It's got that ba 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 da, and then the solo is obviously a Telecaster. You know, very bright, and he's obviously used his tones, and it's just beautiful because all of a sudden it's that juxtaposition between the Telecaster and the Gibson, and he works them beautifully. The orchestration. You know, I mean, they were never the same after Mike Pinder left, because Mike Pinder was really, he wrote quite a few of the songs along with Justin and John Lodge, the bass player. But, you know, he was also responsible for introducing the Mellotron into the band, you know.
Of course, yeah.
Because he used to work for Mellotron, I believe, Mike Pinder. But because we've actually watched the documentary, we love the Moody Blues. And, but, you know, his guitar playing is just fantastic. And going back to Question, the first track, of course, he was using there a Guild 12-string guitar. And you don't know this, but that's the reason why I bought my 12-string. It wasn't.
I did not know that.
It's exactly. It's the 512, and it's exactly the same model as he used. And it just happened that Tom Petty uses one as well, and Dave Gilmour.
Yeah.
But Dave Gilmour was not the reason why I bought it. It was Justin Hayward. I always saw him, and I always wanted one. And then that opening track there, he used it like a C tuning, a drop C tuning, which I've used. I've nicked his tuning. Sorry, Justin.
Inspired.
No, absolutely nicked. Because he was saying that he accidentally made a mistake when he was tuning that, and he actually just started playing that riff, and it ended up being
really?
Question. Yeah, which is actually two songs, rather like Day in the Life of the Beatles. You know,
yeah.
You can all hear it. There's two songs put together, but he wrote the whole thing, and just absolutely marvelous. But what I can never get over with the mood is listening through cans is actually the sound is pretty distorted because there's so much going on. They've actually stuffed so much onto that record, you know, and the amount of compression they use is there's a lot of compression on there, and it's but when the drums come in, it's like power. Tony Clark, he did something, you know, to that whole sound, and it is distorted, but it's just right. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that song is great. What do you think?
Well, it's because of you that I really started listening to the Moody's. I'd heard about them, but it's like, you know, you don't have a sense of them and you don't understand what they're about, and I'm still learning now, but they're like the cheese in my sandwich.
Yeah.
You know, and the dressing, there's something quite magnificent about them that you don't realise, but that they're so part of me musically now. They're in my blood, in my flesh. I feel that they're so inspirational, and they're just so in a sense, probably not as well known as they should be really, because they're absolutely quite magnificent, and that they inspire me completely.
Well, that album, The Best of the Moody Blues, it's a double album, and every track is it's just absolute, it's killer. There's no filler in it. It's everyone, and it's amazing, you know. They sold 55 million records in total, I think.
Oh, God. Oh, but, yeah, there's that other bit that I wrote, actually. I was just, yeah.
It's incredible,
yeah. Let's not even go there, because, I mean, there's the whole part with the show as well, you know. I want to put some facts in, and I want you to get to know a little bit more about Justin Hayward and his journey with the Moody's and the Moody's, but there's also that bit where you just want to lie back and enjoy the sunshine and the music, you know.
Yeah, that's right. But just how he got into the Moody Blues, it was about 65 that Hayward answered another melody maker had, you know, as
the
I
melody
did
melody maker is like the matchmaker for musicians, isn't it?
Yeah, because Eric Burden of the Animals was looking for a lead guitarist, but he'd already filled the spot. And the Moody's were also in the new in the market for a new guitar player to replace Denny Lane, because the first album, The Magnificent Moody's, they only had one single, which they didn't write themselves on it. And Denny Lane then left and went on to great things, of course, at Wings and
Paul McCartney,
sort of stuff,
yeah.
Paul McCartney, yeah. And, you know, because they started out as a rhythm and blues outfit, but when Justin joined, it seemed to all come together. And it was obviously some creative, you know, match between them that all of a sudden they sprung up. And I remember seeing an interview which is on that documentary with the drummer, that's Graham Edge, isn't it?
That's right. Graham.
And, yeah, Graham Edge, and he's so in awe because he said, you know, it was all going wrong and then Justin arrived and his eyes just rolled because obviously, you know.
Yeah.
And the thing about Justin, you actually don't want to like him because he's, you know, in his day, he was a really good-looking lad, blonde hair, great guitar player, great songwriter, great singer. He made you sick. You know what I mean?
He had it all.
Yeah, he had it absolutely all, yeah.
Yeah.
I can be. isn't life strange? A turn of a page, a book without light, unless with love we ride to throw it away.
The Moody Blues and Isn't Life Strange, and that was released as a single on the 21st of April in 1972 on the Threshold record label, and it reached number 13 in the UK singles charts and number 29 in the Billboard Hot 100. But it was also released on their eighth album called The Seventh Sojourn 6 months later on the 23rd of October. And the Americans had to wait a further 3 weeks for the US release. I don't know why that was. This is great, though. It went to number 5 in the UK album charts and was the band's first American chart topper. It spent a mighty 5 whole weeks at number 1.
Ka-ching.
Yeah, get in there, sunshine.
Well, ka-ching for John Lodge, because he wrote this as well. So Justin didn't write this, but what he did do is that he wrote those gorgeous guitar lines with that beautiful growly fuzz. Where, and, you know, I wonder what Brian May was listening to before he actually started all the Queen stuff, because he was certainly listening to this. This is the it's harmony guitar. It's basically the it's this is proto May, proto Brian May.
Yeah, Justin
Vox
Hayward,
AC30 as well, of course.
Of course,
Vox AC30. You know, and really a semi-solid guitar, rather like Justin Hayward. I just wonder, you know, I'd like to ask him if I ever meet him, old Brian. You know,
it is funny though.
He might be a PhD in astrophysics, but I think he did a little bit of a purloining of tone there, if you ask me, in style. And I can never get over the fierce amount of reverberation on these tracks. It's enormous. You know, Tony Clark, he got the right up, you know. It really is.
It's quite dramatic, isn't it?
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
There's some beautiful moments in that song, though, where it feels very much like a film score. And I grew up with that kind of music to animate the soundtrack to my life. So, and also with a theatre background, it's quite beautiful. It crosses over into all these different places that comfort me and take me on some sort of imagination and an exploration of things.
But that mellotron, and it's actually a Chamberlain he was using on that. It's a similar, it's the same thing. Yeah, you know, I don't really know the difference. I'm not a keyboard player, but it is a similar device where it uses a tape loop rather than anything electronic. It wasn't it was just basically a big tape recorder with, you know, a head and a playback head for each key. The ridiculous things. We've used them, haven't we? You know, we've talked about
this before. Yeah, we did that on the knife, because I know, like with the piano, you've got the metal strings and you have hammers that sort of bang onto them and they go doing.
Correct.
But with the mellotron, you press the key down and there's like it's like you've taken the insides of a cassette tape out and put springs on either end and you press the key down and it plays through like a head. So you're playing it like you're on a tape recorder, and those old fashioned ones, and it goes zing.
And right at the very end, as the spring starts to tighten.
Yeah.
You've only got, is it 7 seconds, 8 seconds?
I think some of them have different tape lengths. I remember that. Yeah. So you had to keep pressing the note every.
It's on and off switch,
two
really.
Two bars, really, if you were in 4/4.
You know, the key. Anyway, so they're a dreadful thing to play, I believe, but, you know, they sound absolutely magnificent. And, you know, Mike Pinder did an incredible job.
This is quite magnificent, really. So you've apparently it was also based on Patchell Bell's Canon in D, again recorded at Decca Studios. And what happened was that a year later, after this album, this huge success of this album, they started writing the follow up album, and they quickly shelved it after Inception because it just wasn't working. And that's when they all agreed to take a hiatus so that they could all just have a break and go off and pursue their own solo careers.
Yeah.
Because I think they'd worn out a bit, and I think they need to keep it fresh. So in that time, Justin was carrying on working with John Lodge, the bass player, and Tony Clark, and he had a hit single in 1975 with a song called Blue Guitar, and he recorded it with members of 10cc.
Yeah, from Manchester. We know that those, Lol Cream and stuff, we know those guys. Strawberry Studios, of course, which I worked a lot at in the 70s and 80s, you know, he was... always hanging around, great times. Lovely to see you. from the fourth album On Threshold of a Dream. Of course, the Moody Blues, released on the 25th of April 1969 in the UK and a month later on the 30th of May in the US. It was the first British number one and also boosted their American fortunes by becoming their first top 20 album. And of course, we've got to remember here that Justin Hayward, who wrote this, still wasn't getting a full royalty because he'd signed off his publishing away to Lonnie Donegan. So Lonnie Donegan was laughing his little socks off, you know, on some locomotive somewhere, you know. But yeah, incredible. But what I love about that. Now we're talking about guitar here. This is super sexy. It's like sex on toast. It's like, it is. That's exactly what it is. With oozing with butter and jam and warm toast, you know. It's the feedback. Oh, God. He's playing. You can hear it. And every note he plays, you can hear it just feeding back underneath. It is absolutely gorgeous. Now, people don't get this because this is what I'm saying, you know. People don't really regard him as a great guitar player. But when you listen in detail, and I know I might be going on here, but he's one of my favourite guys, you know. And I'm going to be doing this over the next show, so I'm the other favourite guitar player. I'm going to wax lyrical about the great sound. It's magnificent. 335, AC30. And this is the first Moody Blues album that I bought, Threshold of a Dream.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and after that I bought the best of, but... That's the first album, and it's worn through. And it's on Durham, because that was the original label that they created, Moody Blues, or it was actually Decca created.
They had Threshold, didn't they? Yeah,
because they created Threshold because they wanted to do a stereo album. We're going to be talking about later on.
Yeah,
you know, the first stereo album that Decca had ever done. But anyway, carry on.
Well, just remember as well, we're not sort of playing chronologically in the show. So we're going back from the last album. So this was released in April 1969. Now, I only just found out because I'm still reading lots of different interviews as the show's recorded live because we play the songs and we chat live. They actually turned down Woodstock.
No.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
Now, I didn't realise that until like literally a couple of minutes ago. And what happened was that they built a solid fan base in Europe playing big festivals, and they played Paris that weekend, the weekend of Woodstock, and then returned to the Isle of Wight Festival. And they said, but ironically, Bob Dylan was put down to play Woodstock, and instead he turned up at the Isle of Wight Festival.
Well, their performance at the Isle of Wight is fantastic.
Yeah.
Have we watched it? I think there's some on that documentary somewhere. I think we need to dig it out because we just love the movie. We can't get enough of these boys, you know?
I mean, it's quite magnificent, really. And what I didn't realise after that was that, you know, Bill Graham, the legendary promoter, had got them over to the United States and he booked them to play the Fillmore East, the Fillmore West. And they travelled through mid-America opening for other bands, and they opened for Canned Heat.
Blimey.
And he was saying that that's really what broke them, was that they actually got into the heartland of America, and they also had a lot of radio play on the FM stations, and that really was a key to their success.
Well, it's
success.
All over FM stations in that time, isn't it? It's,
yeah.
You know, beautiful.
I mean, it's crazy now. I do kind of, I feel a bit sad now that it's not quite the same, that radio's changed so much. Mm. And it's, I love the stories. And I think what an adventure, you know, because these guys have gone from totally broke to an R&B band and then got experimented with sound and tried to become original because they knew you can make a living as a covers band for a few years, but they knew to have longevity in the industry, they had to write their own music. So they had to find their own sound. And so you can see this. And I do love the fact that you so love Justin Hayward's playing and you're helping me understand that, because he does need to people need to know this stuff, because he is a guitar player who writes songs and he's a great guitar player.
Yeah, and you know the other thing I just want to talk about acoustic guitar work, because acoustic guitar and strumming acoustic guitar on rock and roll records is really hard because people always overdo it. But if you listen towards the end of that track,
that's
just
true.
Rewind it back and just listen to his rhythm that he's playing. He's accenting the two and the four. It's absolutely fabulous. Well done, Justin.
You
You're listening to the Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was the Moody Blues, and I'm just a singer in a rock and roll band. And that was first released in 1972 as the final track on their eighth album, Seventh Sojourn. It was later released as a single in 1973, when it went to number 36 in the UK charts, number 12 in the US, and number 4 in the Netherlands top 100 charts.
And John Lodge wrote that as well.
He did.
And this is the last album that's any good. Because all the rest of them are crap. Terrible crap. Because as soon as Mike Pinder left, the magic went, that was it. It's like, you know, a very inauspicious end, in my opinion. Mm. And again, I'm sorry, you know, to the Moody's, because I love you so much, but I was so hideously disappointed with that pile of crap that came up afterwards. It was Octave, because what happened is that Mike Pinder went to live in California. They had this hiatus, didn't they? Then yeah. He went to live in California, and they went over there to record.
Because and he wasn't very happy with the result, was he?
Well, he wasn't. The band weren't happy. They were marooned. The studio had a fire. Then they moved to Mike Pinder's home studio, and they got marooned with a big flood of mudslides and stuff. And it just wasn't happening. There's a lot of tension, and it's a great shame. But they live on. And they're still performing, you know. And I saw them at the Montreux Jazz Festival, actually. And I certainly did, yeah. And
here we go.
Yeah,
I love that, by the way.
In the 80s, I can't remember what it was, 89, something, 88. And they were great, you know.
Darling?
Yes, darling.
Do you know what it's time for now?
What?
I think we should talk about the bass. The bass on that song is hideously difficult to play.
Well, you know why? Because you are a stubborn. I have never met a more stubborn woman.
Why?
Because you won't play with a pick. Because that
That's
is done
true.
With a pick.
That's true.
And therefore, there you are. Now you're smiling
That's
through your
true,
teeth
actually.
Now. That's right. I'm going to get smacked over the head with a soggy tea bag after this show. But it's done with a pick. You can't get that sound without a pick. And I think he's using flatworms and stuff. But
yeah, I wonder what, because our son Jim's given me this amazing present of his P bass. So I'm thinking about
1974 P bass, yeah.
Okay.
Fender. Yeah,
wow. I know. And I picked it up the other day. We've restrung it, and I'm like, I love this. It's just so solid. It's just and I was just thinking then, because when maybe that would be easy to play on that, because it wants a pick, that guitar.
Oh, right.
I know. Remember, I did say to you the other week,
didn't I?
So, but it's like when you're trying to actually, the words are like 150 miles an hour.
Yeah.
The bass is going ding, 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 and you feel like you're a wobbly jelly, and as if someone's just shaking you up and down, or you're on a trampoline in all directions. It's actually. It's intense.
It's very fierce. And again, the guitar, beautiful. Fuzz, you know, I think that's his 335, Fuzz box, AC30, amazing, you know. And again, the other thing is, after this, he went on to other amps and stuff, and he never got that tone, Justin.
He sounds like that with your tone.
Yeah, I know. I'm you know, I really need to meet him. I really need to meet him.
I think he's a really nice chap by the sound of it.
He seems delightful, because on that documentary, he really is beautiful, and he's a lovely
quite charming,
bloke.
Isn't
yeah,
he?
Very charming and very gentle, you know. But his father and mother were both teachers, and you know,
they had quite a strong faith, I believe, because I've just been reading about that as well.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
okay.
So I think he grew up with sort of hymnals, and he has quite sort of that kind of aspect to him and that spiritual side. So there's a couple of things here. So I've just been looking on social media, and John Lodge says about he said, I wrote the song, I'm just a singer. He said, but at the end of it, the lyric is actually, we're all just singers in a rock and roll band. So he wanted to be inclusive with everybody, whether or not you're on stage. So he said, some of us are on stage and some are not. So that's a beautiful thing for John Lodge. And of course, he said he wrote that because in response to fans who mistakenly sort of read guru-like wisdom into their lyrics, he was just trying to level everybody out, you know, going, it's okay, look, you know, there might be this celebrity thing. And what was really quite beautiful is like Justin Hayward said that they'd stay grounded over the years, mostly because the Moody Blues have never really been celebrities, like in that true sense of the word. It's probably because 80% of this is so grounding. He says, it's probably because 80% of what I've done, I failed miserably at.
Wow.
And well, isn't that amazing? He was saying like none of them were celebrities, and it was true in the early days. People just didn't know what they looked like. And you're just who you are. And you remember when we've got a photo of the Moody's
we
put up in the kitchen?
We have.
But I didn't know what they looked like. as a band, and I had to search them out.
Very hairy looking individuals.
They were,
and,
weren't they?
And very, but, you know, the whole orchestral thing, though, and I mean, a lot of people have criticised them over the years, saying they're, you know, a bit over bloated. And it's actually very difficult to play individual tracks from the records because they cut off too soon. And like tonight, it's really difficult fading them in and stuff because there's always a bit from the time before, there's always a bit from the track before that's overlapping into.
Because it's meant to be absorbed and digested and experienced
as an album.
Exactly.
As an album. And these are concept albums. And, you know, they were revolutionary. They were the first one to do the gatefold sleeve, you know?
Yeah.
And the, you know, they were one of the first ones to have their own proper label, you know, with Threshold and, you know, and they've absolutely, they forged out a complete new path.
In white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written, never meaning to send. Beauty I'd always missed with these eyes before. Just what the truth. I can't say anymore, 'cause I love you. Yes, I love you. Oh, I love you. Gazing at people, some hand in hand. Just what I'm going through, they can understand. Some try to tell me thoughts they cannot defend. Just what you want to be, you will be in the end. And I'll I love you. Yeah.
Breathe deep the gathering gloom. Watch lights fade from every room. Bedsitter people look back and lament. Another day's useless energy spent. Impassioned lovers wrestle as one. Lonely man cries for love and has none. New mother picks up and settles her son. Senior citizens wish they were young. Cold-hearted orb that rules the night removes the colors from our sight. Red is gray and yellow white, but we decide which is right and which is an illusion.
Moody Blues, The Night, from their second album and first concept album, Days of Future Past, released on the 10th of November 1967 on the Durham record label. We have this album in Spanish. We bought it in Spain, and not the lyrics and everything, but the actual cover and everything is Spanish. Released as a single, Nights in White Satin, the same day. Went to number 9 in the UK and second in the United States, gaining the highest American chart position of a Moody Blues single, and Magnificent, written by Justin Hayward.
Age 20.
His vocal in that, it actually is a bit out of tune, it's a bit broken parts of it, but it's amazing. It's fantastic. The orchestration by Peter Knight, again, Tony Clark, because it was a real scammer they got this, because they actually managed to wheedle away into Decca, didn't they, to actually record this, thinking it was going to be a classical album,
a Dvorak or something.
And they managed to pull the wool over their eyes, and they released this, and Tony Clark rocked up with it and said, "Well, this is it," and they went all hairless when they heard it. Of course, you know, the rest is history, because it was the defining moment of the Moody Blues, and it always makes me very emotional.
I was going to say, I was honestly just swelling up with tears of joy then listening to that. I mean, that was the Stereophonic Sound, was it? Stereophonic Sound.
Yeah.
I mean, what a track. I can't speak.
Yeah, it's so simple, you know, but beautiful. He wrote it very quickly. He said it was a throwaway song that he wrote. And, you know, but it all really came together from then. And that orchestration, you know, they had to carry on. And that's why, you know, they introduced the Mellotron. I think the Mellotron was on there. In fact, I know it was on there as well. But that's when they took the Mellotron and started, instead of actually using orchestras, they were using their own, you know, keyboards, Mike Pinder again. And that, Mike Pinder actually wrote that. And that's what made the song, because when they were playing it in rehearsal, apparently, that's it. That's it. That's the end of the show.
I know. I can't believe it. Thank you so much for joining us. And I really
hour on this.
I want to do like part two.
Well, next week we have something very special, another one of my favourite guitar players. I'm really indulging myself at the moment. So I think guitar players, producers, engineers, they're all game. So the next few weeks of the Supertone Show, that's what you're going to be hearing. But thanks a lot for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Enjoy.